From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the February 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Unique and Precious Memories. I am Charlotte Webb, a Bletchley Park veteran, and I'm joined by the podcast host and producer Catherine White and Mark Cotton.
Welcome, Betty. In fact, that's the name we know you by, although Charlotte is your proper name. Is Betty a nickname? Is that from childhood?
It's because I was actually christened Charlotte Elizabeth, and then my mother noticed on the family tree in 1700 and something that there was a Betty, and she thought it was rather nice to use that as well.
Oh, wow. Why have one name when you can have two? So we're talking today about Bletchley Park's Oral History Project. It's recorded now nearly 400 veteran interviews, and these are quite in-depth. Each one is unique and precious. Everybody has their own set of memories, and of course they cross over, they intertwine, and they build a jigsaw puzzle, if you like, of what happened at Bletchley Park and its outstations during World War II. And it's important to mention when we talk about this that it is still going strong and we want it to keep going strong. So if you know anybody who might have worked at Bletchley Park or one of its outstations, do encourage them to get in touch and register for their oral history interview. Mark, oral history really is what got you into this in the first place and made you want to start this podcast.
Yeah, we're doing exactly what the core story of Bletchley is, isn't it? Which is to tell the story of the people who worked at Bletchley Park between 1939 and 1945. And what better way is there than have the people tell their own stories in their own words? You know, you can't get better than that, can you?
It's going back to primary source, isn't it? If you're talking about research and you're talking about, you know, reliable information, memory gets clouded over the years. And Jonathan Byrne, the oral history officer, will tell you that people quite often start off by saying, oh, I don't remember very much, and you know, you mustn't rely on what I've got. But when they get going, it flows. Betty, you've shared your story a great deal.
Well, yes, I have. Over the past 20 years, I suppose, I've given well over 100 talks to local groups of people and also to wider audiences around the country. And indeed across the world through telephone conversations and other broadcasting media. So that I feel pleased that I've spoken to quite a number of people who have obviously taken up the interest, because even now I'm getting letters from men mostly in America who are doing projects on the subject.
When you tell your story, for example, you've done lots of talks at schools and with groups where people are literally sitting in front of you, aside from all the media stuff and the sort of bigger, more organised audience for fundraising events and so on. So thinking of that intimate situation where people are get a chance to put their hand up and ask a question when you've finished giving your prepared piece, if you like, what sort of reaction do you get from people and what kind of questions do they tend to ask you about it?
Well, they're very general questions, and some of them are rather naive because they just haven't read enough about the story. But in the main, I found that with older people, and I'm talking about a generation below mine in the main, sometimes they're very much older, and a lot of them have read quite a bit about Bletchley Park from the various authors which keep on coming up with another story. And also, of course, the television programmes have given them a bit more background as well. And particularly recent years, the film The Imitation Game.
Oh, I bet they ask you how true that was.
Yes, they do. And of course, I'm very quick to explain that while that is a good film, a good story, it is not the whole story. And then I go on to tell them about the other six or seven operations which are necessary to get the end product.
People do struggle to grasp just how complex the process was. And once you do start to get a sense of that, that's when the wonder sets in, isn't it? Of how incredible what was achieved actually was. And you're always very modest about your part in it. But I think you rose up through the system to end up with a very important job, which took you onto the Pentagon.
Well, yes, this is true. I don't know why or who discovered that I'm reasonably good at paraphrasing, which meant that I had to handle decoded and translated Japanese messages and then turn them into different wording so that when they were sent on to the commanders in the field in Burma, we hoped that they would not be recognised as having been decoded. And this took me to carry on doing that particular job in the Pentagon in America.
For you personally, why is it so important that these memories are kept alive and these stories are told by the people who were there and people who were involved with them?
Because it's very important that this part of our history is not overlooked or forgotten, because at the time we were literally on a knife edge. I mean, we could well have been invaded and taken over and our lives would have been totally different from that day on. And I'm very pleased to find that a lot of the schools now are including a certain amount of information about the Second World War in the curriculum.
Do you feel it's been forgotten to a degree in the public consciousness that people don't have that very real, immediate sense of danger and fear that there was at that time?
Yeah, we know the outcome of World War II. We know who won. Mm. The problem is a lot of people probably don't realise how close we came to losing.
For how long?
Yeah.
No, they don't. And even a lot of the people at Bletchley probably didn't realise at the time.
No.
I certainly didn't. It's only through later reading and discussion that one realises what a knife edge we were on.
So, Betty, we're 75 years away from World War II now. Do you hope in another 75 years, another 100 years, that people will be able to listen to your story and your colleagues' stories and still know what you did and understand what you did?
Yes, I hope they will, and I hope they'll realise that it was a unique situation, a unique experience, probably something which will never be seen or heard again. I think it's difficult to imagine that other countries haven't got a similar setup, but to me, it's totally unique. We wouldn't be able to put such a story, if you like, on again.
Mm. And you're going to be going out there carrying on telling your story, aren't you?
I certainly hope to, despite my 93 coming up 94 years. I'm blessed with reasonably good health and I hope to get out there, and I always carry some literature about Bletchley in my handbag and I'm still handing it out now.
Well, I went to one of your talks last year and I think one of the first questions, it wasn't even a question, it was someone congratulating you on how good your legs were, wasn't it?
Yes, that has happened to me. I'm glad they can't see them now.
Coming up in this month's episode, we'll hear some of those unique and precious first-hand memories from Jean Cocci, a Royal Navy Wren who worked on the noisy, smelly bomb machines, which helped speed up the daily race against time to find Enigma settings on lots of different networks so that messages could be deciphered in enough time to make the intelligence operationally pin-sharp. It wasn't all fun for Jean, though, and she looks back on a dark chapter in her young life to help us and future generations understand what happened. But first, the baton of celebration is passing down the generations now, as increasingly families of codebreakers come to Bletchley Park to absorb the atmosphere and learn more about what their ancestors achieved. One such proud family is the Hinsleys, whose parents met at Bletchley Park. On the 7th of June 1940, Harry Hinsley warned the Admiralty that German battle cruisers were about to emerge from the Baltic. His advice was ignored, and the very next day the Scharnhorst sank the carrier HMS Glorious. This was but one moment in a highly distinguished career at Bletchley Park and beyond, which included becoming the author of the official history of British intelligence during World War II. Three generations of the Hinsley family came to visit and stopped for a chat with podcast producer Mark Cotton.
I'm Clarissa Lloyd. My maiden name is Hinsley, and my father was Sir Harry Hinsley, and my mother was Hilary Brett Smith, who first met here at Bletchley.
And I'm Hugo Hinsley, the son of Harry Hinsley and Hilary Brett Smith, and we have another brother. So the three of us who grew up together in Cambridge after the war when, not unusually, there was a wartime romance, and then they married in 1945, I think, didn't they? Immediately.
Yeah, 1946. 1946. 1st of April, 1946.
They married. Yeah. And then decided to settle in Cambridge, where my father had been an undergraduate before he was recruited to Bletchley Park.
How many members of the family have we had here today?
I think about 12 or 13 members of the family, including the third generation, the youngest.
I was going to say, it's been three generations today, hasn't it? And what's been lovely to see is that all three generations, obviously the youngest is 3 months.
Yes, three and a half months, yes.
She's not maybe as fascinated as the rest of the family, but all of the family are really proud of their connection to this place, aren't they?
Certainly, yes. It's been very special to come and visit and to learn about their grandfather or their great-grandfather. It's been excellent, yes.
The place has a sort of atmosphere to it, which I think my daughter's 13 now, so she studied history, she knows a bit about the background, but to see the real spaces and the equipment and the furniture and the gloomy rooms, and it has a real sort of atmosphere to it, which I think
really
connects.
It brings it to life to people, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
To be able to see, you can read as many books as possible and look at the very few photos there are, but it doesn't give you that feeling of, like you say, the gloomy huts that they had to work.
They were working in, yeah. I mean, they were pretty grim conditions, working long, long hours on long shifts. I remember reading in one of the huts that there was no heating in that hut.
No, so and I remember my mother saying she had never been so cold as she was at Bletchley during the winters, you know. It was very basic, and it does give you a very good feeling, the way they've done the huts up now, of what it must have felt like, you know, and as you walk along between the rooms, you can imagine what it was like with the bustle of these young people getting on and working hard here.
You'd visited before, hadn't you, a number of years ago?
Yes. The last time we came was in 2010, when we brought my uncle and aunt, who are my father's youngest brother and sister, who are now in their middle 90s. And we came as a big family group of 16 men. And this was before they had done all the work doing up the huts and refurbishing things. So it's been very interesting to see it and to see the wall with all the names on that we saw when we walked in. It's been interesting.
The younger generations now should understand what that history was. And the extraordinary, the technical stuff is fascinating, but for me what's really interesting is this sort of human effort, the incredible commitment and extraordinary mix of people making it work.
It's the service that those people gave, the country, and in a way continue to give for, 30 years plus afterwards, by not talking about what they're doing. Because as you grew up, you knew nothing about what your parents had done, did
No.
you?
We knew nothing about what they did in the war. We knew they'd met in the war and waited till the war was finished to marry. And they never really spoke about it, really, until my parents were in their sort of 70s or so, and my father had written this official account of the war. And even then, he very rarely spoke about it. It was my mother who was more giving of information and chatting about what it was like. But we had no idea when we were growing up. Then just no one spoke about it. And their friends who came to visit, they obviously had very close friends who they'd met here and been here.
They
never really said anything much at all. It was incredible, the secrecy and the fact that it just wasn't possible to talk about it.
I mean, probably with your father being so important, because let's face it, Harry Inslee was one of the most important people here, along with Turing and Welshman and Denniston.
Yeah.
I mean, his direct link down to naval headquarters in London. Yeah.
Yes.
And the coordination with the Americans.
Yes. All the things that he did. I mean,
he
instigated the pinches that we did. He was fundamental to this place. He probably suffered the same problem that Gordon Welshman spoke about, which was, even after the secret came out, not knowing how much they could talk about. Because obviously, even when it came out in 1974, there was still so much that was secret. You didn't know if I talk about this thing, is that something I know about?
That people have already spoken about, or am I actually giving away secrets that shouldn't be talked about? Yeah, I'm sure.
Remember, the whole of his academic life, as he developed in the post-war period, was fascinated with the Cold War and the whole secret war going on across Europe. So he was very well aware of the incredible importance of intelligence, of secrecy, and so on. So his instinct would always be, don't say anything unless it's necessary. And I think he kept that all through his life. He never relaxed. And when he wrote the official history, obviously, he was instructed that he could relax, and indeed he should put everything into the official history, because they had to do a second cut of it. The first one was to be only for the archives. And then when Mrs. Thatcher came to power, so at the end of the 70s, Cabinet Office got really annoyed that there were an increasing number of paperbacks coming out with completely false sort of fantasies about what was happening. And they said, why don't we release an edited version
of the official history.
So that it is, for the first time, on record, and they can't have all these silly stories. And so he was asked to go back and remove any reference that would be traceable to any person. So the official history still exists in the archive, and the historians can use it later, but the one that's published by HMSO is a sort of cut version.
Filleted.
Though it's still five volumes.
Yes. Pretty massive. I mean, it's one hell of a
It's an extraordinary thing. It's the only time somebody's tried to put together the whole of an intelligence operation for all of the theatres of war and all of the forces together into some coherent picture. It's quite extraordinary that one person could do that. And he did it. He wrote always by hand with a Parker pen on the back of old examination papers of his students. So in his office, you'd always have a pile of old examination papers, and he'd be there writing, and then he'd annotate and so on, all by hand. And then he had one or two dedicated secretaries who would then type it up, and then he'd re-annotate.
Only people who could read his handwriting, because he had quite, you know, scrawly handwriting, and a couple of secretaries were very good at that.
And he always said, that's the only way I can really think something through. I have the pen in my hand. The level of concentration was immense. And when he was writing the book, Power and the Pursuit of Peace, which was sort of in the middle of his period, I remember I was during a period when I was at school, I was around quite a lot, and he was absolutely fixated on it. And he was very proud. We used to go for a walk for the weekends, and say, the past 3 weeks I've written a chapter a week, and this is the fastest I've ever. So he was really, really into it. Whereas the official history was a grind for 10 years.
And with the official history, he had to ask other people for their particular thing in an area that perhaps he wasn't so familiar with. So he did an awful lot of research, talking to old friends, acquaintances, and saying, you know, I know what you were doing, but, you know, what's the best way of putting that down and so on. So he had to do a lot of research, which is why I think it took about 10 years.
Massive job.
So, but he really enjoyed doing it. I think he felt it was very important to get it straight and have it written down for posterity, for people to read and to understand what an amazing, you know, time the country had been through, really.
Was there a specific, we need to have a conversation about what we did during the war?
No. Just little things slow. Were dropped
little
as they got older.
Slip out. Especially my mum used to talk about, they lived in, she and three other friends, I think. Initially they were billeted in Bletchley. And then they went to a cottage called the White Cottage in Simpson, which was part of a farmhouse there. And they managed, I think, these four women together to rent or to be allowed to use that cottage. So that became their sort of base. And she had anecdotes about how they, you know, they used to go out for the evening and walking back across the fields in the fog after doing a night shift and stumbling into the cottage and collapsing in complete exhaustion. And stories about the wonderful farmer's wife, Mrs. Bates.
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Bates.
And every now and again, Mrs. Bates would have a pig who self-died, because it was illegal, of course. So every now and again, if a big event was coming up, Mrs. Bates would just sort of...
she used to come and borrow the tin bath, for the demise of the pig.
Yes.
And then a joint of pork would be put on the windowsill when they came home, you know. But
so
they have very happy memories. But I mean, our mother, who spoke most about it, didn't do so till she was well into her 70s and so on. Often it would be sparked off by an old friend from here visiting, and they'd start to chat, and then a little story would come out, and we'd hear a little bit of something. So we were aware about it, about what they were up to when we were in our 20s, really, for the first time.
So, they never said, now we've got to tell you about this, this is very serious. It was just,
it's just what happened during the war and what they were doing, as far as they knew. course.
Well, a lot of the veterans, they got to the end of the war and they'd put their lives on hold for 6 years. And part of the keeping the secret was the fact that, well, they just wanted to get on with their lives.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
And like your parents,
very strange.
They got married and they, that's when they started their lives.
Yeah. And it was almost as if it was a sort of just a little special moment in their lives. And then after Bletchley and after the war and so on, they almost seemed to take a deep breath and sort of feel, right, now we get on and we put that behind us. Though it must have been an incredibly special
and
time.
They were so very young. This is what's so amazing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them were in there.
These are 20, 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just incredible.
A 25-year-old here was an old person.
Yeah.
The responsibility on their shoulders and this sort of bubble they were in. And then when it finally ended, it must have been weird. I mean, suddenly the world out there was out there.
Yes.
And they
yeah.
could, you know, breathe again. It must have been very, very strange. But they all seem, I mean, as far as we know, I mean, there were some pretty eccentric friends, but none of them went actually mad.
No.
But the pressure on them would have been tremendous. The working hours and the knowing that you were responsible for tremendously difficult decisions.
And not really knowing what your other friends were doing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to mention was about our mother, who was Hilary Brettsmith, and she was working in Hut 4 and met my father here when he started coming down from London. And one of the things that she told us very late in her life was how she first got here, because she had finished at Oxford, where she took her degree, and she went to America to a university called Wellesley, almost as a gap year, because English...
A master's
degree. She did a master's. And while she was in Wellesley, the war broke out, and obviously a lot of her close friends at Oxford, male friends, and her brothers and all sorts of people were going off to war seriously. And so her friends in America said, for goodness sake, don't go back to England. Stay here. You know, you don't want to get involved in all this. And she said, no, I must go back. I'm sure there's something I can do. She went back to Oxford. She went to London and saw friends, and she asked if she could do something using her brain. And she was eventually given a job driving an ambulance in the Blitz in 1939 and into 1940. And one of her very close friends from Oxford was working, I don't know whether he was in the
War Office
somewhere.
Yeah.
And he was a contemporary of hers from Oxford and a great friend. And she said, can I come and see you? And he said, yes, delighted to see you. And she went to see him and she said, how can I do something for the war effort that is using my brain? I mean, I can drive an ambulance, but, you know, I know
it's
I could
waste,
do other things.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be able to do something. And he said, well, there is something going on, but they're not accepting women yet. And he said, I can't really talk much about it, but I'll have a word. And he said, the one great advantage about you is that on paper you have a man's name, because your
Hilary.
Christian names are Hilary Brettsmith, and you could be a man on paper, so we will see if we can't get you an interview in this place I'm thinking about. And that is how she actually got here, because once she was able to meet people face to face and got an interview, they said, well, we are beginning to take a few women and we might consider, you know, interviewing you. And that's how she first got to Bletchley, which I think is a very important story as well in her life. And then after a few, you know, a year or so later, suddenly there were an enormous number of women coming down doing the, you know, the secretarial, the code breaking and admin and so on.
Yeah.
So that's something I remember very strongly.
To be allowed into the cryptography side of things as a woman was very rare.
Very rare.
When she started. I think she came in 1940.
I think 1940.
End of 1940 sometime.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because your father was a very early starter here, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
It was quite fascinating. He
was recruited right at the beginning.
Yeah.
He was here in 1939.
Yeah.
Though he was working in London in the naval office a lot of the time.
Yeah, he started,
as well as coming down here.
He was moving backwards and forwards between the Navy in London and here.
What was he doing prior to the war?
Well, he was an undergraduate at St. John's College. He was a scholarship boy. In those pre-war days, it wasn't unusual for very poor working-class kids to manage to get up through the grammar school system and then to get a scholarship. He was brought up in Walsall, near Birmingham, and the son of a coal worker, a carter, and a
school caretaker.
Big family, lots of children, very poor. But he was picked out by his teachers in primary school as being bright. They managed to get him a scholarship into the grammar school, the local Walsall, which is a very good grammar school.
St. Mary's.
And from there, he got a goldsmith scholarship from City of London to go to Cambridge, which is amazing. So he moved from the back streets of Walsall to being in Cambridge in 1938. and did his first year.
Medieval history.
Medieval history was his subject at that time.
And then he decided to go on a bit of a sort of holiday with his rucksack round Germany in the summer of 1939.
Yep.
After his first year, he was very intrigued about what was happening in Germany. So he set off with his rucksack and
hitchhiked all over Germany.
And as the summer was going on, it was quite clear that things were getting really, really serious. In fact, at one point, he had a ride in Hitler's car.
Yep.
Hitler had been to one of his great talks, his great things where he was giving great one of speeches, his early speeches. And his driver was driving around in a very beautiful,
Mercedes.
It was a Mercedes, I think. And my father, who was a very blonde young man, was hitching, and this huge and beautiful car stopped. And the driver said, "Where do you want to go?" Was it near Munich?
I think it was near Berchtesgaden. He was walking down from having been up to have a look at that and got this lift back down to the town.
And the chauffeur
wasn't
said,
in the car, of course.
No, the chauffeur said, "I can give you a lift to the outskirts, but I have a very
important person to
pick up, so I can't take you into the town, but I'll drop you." And my father said, "Well, who are you picking up?" And he said, "Herr Hitler." That was quite something.
But he also said that he could have changed the course of history, because at some point during that time he was in Munich, he said he was standing within, across the room from here, of Hitler. He was standing outside a building. He was standing there. If he'd had a gun...
And if he had known what was going to happen.
What was going to happen. So he said it was extraordinary in a way how casual the whole thing was. This huge Nazi machine was building up, but they weren't really protecting themselves. There wasn't high security. They were so proud of themselves. And he, as a blonde young man, looking sort of like young German, just wandered around.
And he spoke good German, too.
And he spoke
obviously he was a foreigner, but he spoke good German, so he could understand a lot of what was going on.
I mean, he could obviously feel that things were going badly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And just got out as things closed down.
Made his way back in time for the term to start in October, and it was at that point, going into his second year, that they were still scouting for people from Oxford, Cambridge, and other important universities, that bright young people in it, and it was then that he was picked up. One of his tutors recommended they have a look at him, and he was whizzed off to London to Naval Intelligence. And then he got involved at the beginning of Bletchley. So he was here in 1939.
Yeah, I think he was
and
here.
Early 1940. Very early on, I think.
You're both very, very proud of your parents.
Oh, absolutely, it's an amazing, strange story. I mean, all of these people that we've seen today were phenomenal people, and it was a most incredible time, and I think it's absolutely fascinating what they were doing. We're very proud.
And the other generations are as well.
I mean, your daughter, who's 13, she's
very interested.
She's seen The Imitation Game and things, which obviously glorifies things a bit, but she's very interested. This is her second visit here today.
It's lovely to see the pride in the families.
Absolutely.
A lot of the veterans have passed on now, like your parents have, but in keeping their history alive and keeping their story alive and what they did alive, and that's what's important.
It's wonderful to see how the place has developed over the last years, it really is a very sort of comprehensive view of what happened at a most extraordinary time in our history, really, isn't it?
Thank you so much, and thank you for your time.
Thanks
for helping to show us around.
It was great, and we've really loved the way it's developing, and we'd like to come back in a few more years and see how things move on.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This half term at Bletchley Park, drop-in workshops, Think, Make, Do, Cyber, will be running all week. Games and activities help kids aged 5 to 14 to explore the subject of online safety and discover how that relates to the Bletchley Park Codebreakers. The workshops are included in the ticket price during half-term week, but children must be accompanied. Check the website for dates and times. To add a spot of glamour to your day at Bletchley Park, try the Make Your Own Vintage Accessory Workshop with Claire from Clarabella's Closet. Claire has always had a passion for vintage fashion, and her guiding hand with felts and florals make for the perfect Mother's Day treat on Saturday the 4th of March. Podcast producer Mark Cotton caught up with Claire.
So what we've got coming up is a bit of a new thing for Bletchley Park, and you're going to be doing a vintage accessories make-it-yourself workshop.
Yes.
So is that where are you going to be teaching people how to do these?
Yeah, I'm going to be encouraging and just showing people that you start with a blank canvas and using vintage techniques and like felt and even artificial flowers now. Using all those techniques, you can come up with something rather spectacular and something that they'll be able to take home with them and recreate.
Yeah.
And just experiment as well. Just demonstrating the basic felt flowers where you cut the petals, there's different sizes of petals. And then also on the dried flowers, giving them a blank canvas and they can arrange it before they put, if they choose glue, they can. But if they want to sew it on, that kind of thing. And just let them go free and just design what they want to, yeah. Because that's how I work. What people would be actually doing on the day, obviously with the artificial flowers, they're all already made, but with the felt, they'll be cutting the petals out themselves, they'll be sewing them together and making from scratch. So, and then adding the brooch back or the hair clip back, they can have whatever they prefer really on the back.
So instead of just coming away with something that's been made by someone else, they're actually going to walk away with something that they've made themselves, aren't
they? They will make themselves. They'll be given the opportunity to make a felt hair flower, a felt brooch, and they will also be given the opportunity to make a artificial flower, brooch or hair piece. It's going back to the roots of make, do and mend. It's gathering what you've got at the time. Then making something really lovely out of it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Jean Cotchie tells a story of oil stains, monotony and exhaustion in the rural outreaches of the home counties. Hardly what she had in mind when joining the Navy to do her bit for the war effort. Jean welcomed volunteer David Stern to her house to share her story so that the Bletchley Park Oral History Project can preserve it for future generations and help to build the complicated jigsaw of who did what for the Government Code and Cipher School throughout World War II. She's one of nearly 400 veterans to have contributed so far. We were privileged to sit in as she shared her very colourful memories.
I'm in the midst of typing up your story at the moment, and it's fascinating all the things that you've told me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You get a chance to correct it for me.
I probably won't think it's me, some other person. It haunts me, though. When I think of Bletchley, it does haunt me. Especially going up that lovely drive for the first time from Crawley Grange. We were told from London when we weren't typists or nurses or cooks or weren't any use to them, we were going to go on special duties. And it was the best quarters the Wrens have had in the whole country. So that was nice. And we got in a coach and we went into North Crawley, turned into a drive, and this gorgeous house. I thought, they're right. Are we going to be here? It's a beautiful house. And from there, we went daily into the park for training. But I thought I was going to live there, of course. But I was only there while I was trained. I was so sorry to leave it.
Where did you go from there?
From there, I went to Wavendon House.
And what was that like?
Quite a nice house. And it has a lovely lake and tennis courts.
Am I right in thinking that if you're in lovely surroundings for your accommodation, that's great, but it's a bit of a contrast with the work itself?
Oh, well, that was it. That was the thing that hit me hard.
Tell me about that.
We weren't aware that they were concentrating on camouflage all the time. Camouflage. So they wouldn't have a lot of reds together or a lot, you know, it was a very sort of broken up. A huge kitchen was there for the Wavendon people living there. People fed us. But the actual huts we worked in were out of the kitchen. I remember walking across a lane and these little row of cottages, and between the cottages there was a passageway into a wood, and the huts were hidden in the wood. And probably, looking back, that was why they chose Wavendon, because it had, you know, camouflaged woods around them.
It had to not look important sky, didn't it?
No,
Exactly.
And of course, the camouflage was ugly, but you couldn't make the house look bad. It was quite a nice house.
There was a whole belt all around the home counties of these houses taken over, weren't there?
Oh, yes, there were. I wanted to know from you, didn't I, if they went to Woburn House, because with a lovely programme on Woburn House. And I know Res went there, but I didn't know whether they worked there.
No,
they
billeted. A good number of them were billeted there.
Billeted there.
But they were the ones that would be bussed in every day to Bletchley.
Yes, yes.
They tell me it was freezing.
Was it?
Oh, at Woburn Abbey.
At Woburn Abbey, it wasn't comfortable at all. And so they had a tea urn. When you came off a shift, rather than drink the tea, you didn't waste it on drinking it. You put it in your hot water bottle because it was so cold. For the best. So I think you were... Even though the work was grim, if your accommodation was comfortable, I think you were fairly lucky.
Mm.
Do you remember it being cold, Mum?
No, I don't remember, darling. I can't remember.
Did you make some friends that you stayed in touch with later?
Well, one or two. I had the list from you kindly sent me. I couldn't really recognise anybody because I honestly didn't. We didn't keep up with them because I was sort of invalided out of Wabenden. I got so tearful and wasn't eating, so I was useless.
Was that the shift pattern, do you think, how tiring it was?
Yes. Well, that and the loneliness of it at nights, working through the night alone. I had perhaps somebody come in would give me a sheet of what to, you know, to put all the things in the right place.
Menu,
yes. But said hello and went out again, I signed a form there'd been, and then I was left on my own. And I'd had such a super... few years before I would join the Reds, that I loved company, and I was brought up in a school, so you know, working on my own was horrid.
It was a shock, I should think.
At night too, when you're normally in bed asleep, you know,
your mind does
suddenly
funny things to you.
You'd sort of sit there waiting for it to stop, and it would all stop. So you had to take everything off, get the papers out, look at the menu, put the next slot up, you know, and then press the button to get it going, then sit down again and wait for it to go. Round it went, you know. And you looked at it, it must be dawn soon, and you looked at it, it was sort of 11:30 or something, you know. You said, oh, no.
Nothing drags like a night shift, does it? Did you used to do a whole week of nights at a time? Do you remember? It was quite
yes,
grueling, wasn't it?
It would have been a week.
Were you not paired up on the bomb? Were you talking about working on your own? I've not heard of that before.
Oh, no, it's not.
I think that's important. I've picked that up from what Jeannie has told me too.
Mm.
Our understanding usually was that the Wrens acted in pairs. And the reason it's had such an effect on Jeannie
was that I was on my own.
Quite so.
Oh,
she would work 8-hour shifts in the woods.
Not funny.
One bomb per hut.
Mm.
Entirely on her own for 8 hours through the course of the night with these hot smokes.
People would come with the menu, would keep coming in, would come in from 2 or 3 times in the night.
Mm.
But then you weren't on the right wavelength from working from midnight to 8 in the morning. You know, you're usually in bed asleep, so it was hard to be awake anyway. It was odd.
So how did you come to be invalided out? Did you get so that you just felt poorly and couldn't?
I went off food and. I was getting just low and tearful, and I don't know whether they'd had it before, but I had my bicycle up there, I think, and they sent me to a lovely, lovely family doctor in the village about 2 miles away. And I cycled there, and I think he summed me up straight away that I was exhausted, and he recommended this girl should be sent to an outdoor job immediately. That's when I went down to Sheerness in the mail office in the dockyard, chatting up all the sailors.
That sounds better.
Better than being in the woods on your own at night, isn't it?
Well, we had a boat and an old crew of two old, real old sailors, lovely old boys, who used to take us out into the harbour of Sheerness when ships came in, and were we popular. We had all their mail on board, and we had the mail to pass to them alongside the ship, you know, huge ship. And out of one porthole there would come a glass, and out of the other probably a gin and tonic to pass to me in the boat alongside with the mail. That was lovely. We went aboard sometimes too. And then we had a minesweeping one that went... We had a boat called Tudno, St Tudno, but it was Tudno, down the river, that was... It was stationary. I mean, it was... You know what I mean?
Moored.
Moored, thank you, Linny. And it had an office on board for all the minesweepers. And, of course, they were sort of old-school public school boys, you know. And having been to a public boys' school, I was perfectly at home with them. And it was lovely taking their mail and having a little tot of rum and having a chat. I told you all this, didn't I?
You did.
When you see how vivid my memory is, 94, it's as clear as a bell. A lovely photographic memory, which is great, because I can see all the good things apart from the bad. My dad didn't talk about the First World War at all. I've learnt an awful lot since. And I found photographs of the Cameron that was sunk in the Mediterranean, and he was taking out a group of men to Bombay, and they were torpedoed, and he had to sort of jump in the water with the last young man that couldn't swim, and all that. You know, he lost a lot of them, and he got picked up and taken to Malta, and from Malta they got him back. It must have been horrifying, and that's why when he was a headmaster of a boys' school, the only thing he would expel a boy from school was when they went to the swimming baths to push another boy in. They were taught never push another boy in the water.
I think there are some defining moments in your life, aren't there, that things that then shape the rest is stay with you. And maybe those horrible nights alone in the woods in that hut have stayed with you.
Well, so much happened afterwards when I left, you know, the whole of Bletchley Park behind me, which I wasn't fit for, really. We were sent there because we weren't any use to, in other ways. I wasn't a nurse, I wasn't a cook, I wasn't this, I wasn't that. So it was an open field. They just sent, we're sent it. She's had a good schooling, or been to a good school. We're sent her to Bletchley.
It's more the opposite, isn't it?
I think they were looking for certain qualities. They seem to get...
Well, yes.
They'll have been observing you during basic training without you realising.
Oh, that wouldn't have done me any good, because when I was helping in the kitchen, they had a huge machine that was feeding the whole of the people in the building, the students and the staff, and we put the potatoes in and press the button, and off it went, peeling the potatoes. And I stopped it, and it all went all stuck all on over the ceiling because I pressed it the wrong time.
And they put you on pioneering technology that we were relying on to find the U-boats.
We discussed the selection. You were saying that they asked you if you were keen on crosswords or puzzles, and none of which you were.
Yeah.
But then you told me that you felt that your selection was because you were a public school girl.
Yes.
And also because you were the only girl in an entire boys' public school.
Yes.
So it had a sense of independence and spirit about her.
Mm.
That's what you said to me, remember? Mm. Do you think that's probably what swung it?
Probably.
Nobody really knows why they were picked. Mm. It's all guesswork, isn't it? But it's interesting, isn't it, to think about what
stood you
out.
To get rid of me, really. I loved squadrille, you know, all that. I loved all that movement. But when I had to scrub the chief officer corsets, I didn't fancy that.
Scrubbing corsets? Good grief. But you were scrubbing the chief officer's corsets?
Yes, in her private flat.
Had you done something wrong?
Hampstead Training Centre.
Was this a punishment?
Oh, no, I think probably an honour.
You were saying that you weren't good enough to be a nurse or something else. They gave you a job at Bletchley. At that time, that was the most important role you could have had in the Wrens, because you were a Wren special duty.
That's right.
So you were more important than any of those other Wrens.
Oh, my headmistress told me I was fit for nothing.
You were one of the select few.
The elite.
But no, we just want you to realise that you were special. It was a very select few that were selected.
There'd be something about you that was picked out as a different.
Absolutely. Of all of the different duties you could have been given in the Wrens, yours was the most special.
You were entrusted with something very important. If we then fast forward 30 years to when it all started to come out in the 70s, was that a shock to you?
Well, I don't know about shock. I suppose I had just put it into cold storage, I think.
I always get the impression everybody after the war, certainly the first few years after the war, wanted to put it behind them.
Oh, very much put it behind you. Yes, definitely. Yes.
Because it had been so difficult for everybody.
Well, yes, but things made... As soon as you got out of the service, you got back to colour and people, you know. It was the colour, the drabness. When I first went back to Bletchley after my first visit back, the entrance up that lovely tree-lined drive, and at the end then the black and white splodge of the submarine or something that's on the banks right the way up on the left... haunted me all the way through that. Mm. You've got to give up something, haven't you, for peace? We were doing something to contribute to the war. I know I was there when Bismarck was found, which was exciting, good news. Hush, hush.
So once you were invalided, you had a much better posting then to the mail ship. That was, sounds like...
Oh, that was magic.
A good time.
That was where she met her husband.
Uh-huh. Plenty of young men to choose from.
The minesweepers were mostly RNVR, sort of public school boys. And it was fun going aboard with their mail. It was lovely. It was nice.
It must have felt like going home after growing up in a boys' school.
Oh, it was. It was lovely. And I had a funny old... A lovely, funny old van. I used to pick up the mail from the mail office in Sheerness and drive to Minster and places on the island with the mail. Of course, you were so popular as soon as you arrived because they knew what they brought you. But it was the latter part on the Isle of Sheppey was lovely. And the town was nice. And it was bubbling with Wrens and RAF and all sorts of WAFs and service people. I went over to Laysdown halfway. We used to go over to Minster, where there was an Air Force delivering there. At the far end of it, nearer where you live, there were two old girls that had a huge bungalow, and they entertained all the service people that went there. They got so tiddly, two old girls, they got so tiddly. They used to feed us, and we used to take drink with us because it would be off round ration. And they'd make us so welcome. We'd have such a real sort of civvied evening. And there were lots of little dotted caravans and everything around us there, which was magic to go to. And I was so pleased I got mail to deliver there too.
Looking a little bit more recently to when you approached about the Oral History Project and asked to share your memories, what did you think when you were first asked about that?
In this particular instance, Jeannie and I are friends. Linnie Arriva and I are friends. Linnie is Jeannie's daughter. And it came out quite by accident in conversation at a small reunion that they had a few weeks ago that Linnie's mother worked at Bletchley Park. And of course, my sister-in-law said, oh, my brother-in-law works at Bletchley Park too. And one thing has led to another. So I got in touch with the Oral History Department, Jonathan Byrne, and said, look, I've found another one. Can we do it? And although it's a little bit out of my catchment area, I beg to do this particular one because such a nice lady and we're friends. And that's how it came about.
Did you like the idea? Did you think it seemed odd that somebody would be so interested in
I love meeting people. Yes, no, it was fine.
Did you find that you remembered more than you thought you did when you started talking about it?
Yes, it does revive things in your memory. Yes, I think it does. Yes.
Of course, you put it all away in cold storage, as you said yourself, didn't you?
Yes.
So it all sat dormant for a while.
Yes, and when it was open to the public, I went with some of the family. Then I realised I could come back here.
So it's obviously quite a set of dark memories and not a place you much fancied going back to.
I don't ponder on the dark times.
No.
Too many lovely things have happened since.
Good, good.
Mm.
There's lots of different people who are doing different jobs in different locations around the country and around the world. Does it feel like you're part of something bigger than you realised at the time, perhaps? You get more of a sense of what the bigger picture was. And
oh, yes. You didn't realise it till you left Bletchley, really.
Did you ever discuss any of your wartime work with Alan, your husband? Because he was in the Navy too. Did you discuss it with him?
Not really, because he didn't discuss what he did to me.
Mm.
We went through sort of civvy life and having a family of three and him getting going in business and sport. He was a great sportsman. And I was glad to pick up the things I liked, like amateur dramatics and things that... No, it was easily shut off, right off.
Yes.
But I never believed what he said that he was doing, because he told me that he lived in Hassocks in Sussex, and the year before the war, he and his brother went to Hove, down by Brighton, joined the Royal Naval Voluntary Reserve, went every week for training. When war broke out, they joined up. They went actually down to Rio, right round the Cape. I remember him talking about it. He closed up about everything.
Yes.
So I naturally did. But from time to time, we met odd people who seemed to remember him. He told me that he took a group of sailors, what would they be?
Party of sailors.
Yes. Mm. Through the Panama and down to New Zealand. They stopped off at Fiji, where he, as a young officer, spent the night in a bedroom that had the hugest spider on the wall he'd ever seen. It was like a crab. He couldn't get to sleep till he got his shoe and sloshed it one, and it left a leg behind. Oof. And I always remember him.
No, he said, didn't he complain to the manager?
Yes.
He complained to the manager, yes, and they said, oh, yes, sir, there's one in every room.
Yes, especially to eat the other.
Yeah, they got rid of all the other
bugs. Don't they?
Yes.
But he then went on to New Zealand, to Auckland, and he vowed to me when I could tell him about Bletchley, but he vowed to me always that he was sports and entertainments officer. And of course...
In Devonport,
New Zealand.
Yes.
New Zealand.
And I remember when I first went to New Zealand, the first time I went and stayed with his ex-girlfriend, who was gorgeous, we're great friends, lovely lady. Oh, she's a super, isn't she?
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
We
were going into the new cathedral, lovely new cathedral, and there was two or three fellas in front of us, and we walked up the path, and Daphne was her name, and she said, guess who I've got with me? I've got Alan Koch's wife with me. So he turned around and said, hello. And one of them said, yes, he mentioned about something private, something, you know, what would it be? Not sports, it would be...
Signals? Intelligence?
Yes, intelligence. Well, intelligence. And that's the first time that anybody had dropped a hint that Alan was doing it. And I knew that he wasn't sent out there with his ability to be sports and entertainment officer.
He wasn't singing and dancing.
No, he wasn't. Definitely not.
The family are pulling off the forms where they can send off to get Alan's wartime records.
That'd be good, yeah.
Which will help. But
we love it.
Just judging from what you told me of the time he was where he was and he was in the Falkland Islands and so on, we rather think at the moment, which is yet to be proved, that he was involved in the Battle of the River Plate, which is the Graf's Bay. But that we don't know yet.
No.
You just have to pull the records off. But what I was keen to find out is, he wasn't telling you what he did, but did you at any time tell him what you did about Bletchley?
Not before 50 years were up, whatever the years were.
Oh, you kept the secret time?
Yes, yes.
So it must have been a relief to you, at least then, to be able to say something.
Well, even though it was don't a grim forget time. I'd been pregnant and looking after babies and growing flowers and getting a bit of colour around me instead of black and white camouflage. Yeah. Besides, I was destined for the stage anyway.
Well, you trod the boards before the war, didn't you?
Yes.
For a while.
Mm.
No wonder being on your own didn't sit so well.
No, have an audience. Exactly.
We know that you were at Wavendon working with the bombs for 2 years, and I certainly can appreciate what that must have been like in the hut on your own, night after night, day after day, for these 8 hours in those noisy, smelly huts and so on. But for how long did you experience ill health? In other words, how long did you put up with it when you were well?
Well, probably if I showed any signs of ill health, it would be if I stopped eating. I had a natural, normal appetite. And I was always ready to have a meal.
But did that come on rather rapidly towards the end of the 2 years, or had you been not well for a long time?
Oh, no, it came on noticeably. Must have been noticeable, because someone must have reported and said, I think this girl ought to see a doctor.
Did you find the authorities sympathetic once it had been established that you were suffering as you were?
Well, they were pretty quick to get rid of me, really.
Well, yes, there's a difference between getting rid of you and being sympathetic. I'm wondering if they probably didn't.
Well, I think
others.
It was the doctor's report. He was a lovely family doctor, obviously a lovely old man. And I think I started weeping with him because I had to tell him what I felt. And I think he just said this girl should be removed as soon as possible to an outdoor job.
Did he know what you were doing?
Oh, I should think he did.
Because there must have been certain people in positions that would need to...
Yes, I probably wasn't the only one. Well, I met one or two at the reunions I went to, and I went over to somebody sitting on her own on the other side of that big sitting room in the front of the house, and sat down and said, where were you? And she said, and I said, were you happy? And she said, no, I was terribly unhappy here. She was the first person that was... owned up straight away that it was an absolute nightmare.
It's interesting just how important colour and vibrancy and life, if you like, is to you.
Yeah.
And so for me, so very easy to understand why in the dismal, dark,
yes,
bomb rooms.
And as, yes, thank
it
you.
It would have had, yeah, such a dreadful effect.
I know.
I find that very easy to understand.
Yes, I expect you do.
So few people do understand that, and that's important to tell that story.
David, turning to you, obviously you get to come and bask in all the detail of these lovely stories.
Yes, it's a huge privilege. I never thought I would end up doing this as a voluntary job after I retired. And I've managed to swing it that I could interview 26 now to date. And I also transcribe other people's interviews. So I've done, I think, 27 of those to date. So what's that, 53? 53 in total. So by now I'm building up this huge picture, at least in my mind, of what the veterans did. And that's why when I picked up on the selection process, you're quite right. Some were asked if they were good at crosswords or puzzles or did the times, whatever. And some simply don't know why they were picked because they were, you know, they had other reasons in the
background. All sorts of things: discretion, lateral thinking, problem solving, reaction to things going wrong. We don't know, do we? Because that's shrouded in secrecy.
But to answer your question more fully, yeah, it is an absolute privilege. Everyone is different. There are a vast number of different backgrounds and the jobs that they did too. I've interviewed ladies who became cooks and orderlies and chauffeur. One lady who's a chauffeur, all the way through to bomb operators and up to cryptanalysts and what have you. So a broad spectrum. Huge privilege. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's a few years that fit into the whole tapestry of someone's life. The war changed everything for everyone that was involved in it and lived through it. Everything became, you know, before and after. It's an important chapter in the life of everyone that lived through it. So you couldn't pick six other years in someone's life and say, well, you know, how did that shape the rest of your life? In quite the same way.
You are absolutely right. You know, it's remarkable. All the people that we speak to, by definition, were in very much their formative years. They're all sort of 17 and a half, 18, 19, very impressionable. So when they were told on pain of death that, you know, this was the Official Secrets Act and you will say nothing, otherwise you're likely to be shot, they took that very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that carried through many of them till they left us and never told us what they did. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. It's a pivotal time in their lives. It would be a pivotal time in anyone's life from 19 to, say, 23, 24. But here they are. They either knew it then or they find out later that, what was it Eisenhower said? They shortened the war by 2 years and saved tens of thousands of lives. How more important to the war effort could that possibly have been? So yes, it's incredible what I find out when we're talking to them. And they're all, including you, my dear, all so self-effacing, all think that, well, we didn't do much. We only just turned a few cogs or a few wheels. But sometimes it's my privilege to be able to say, just as you've done, you did far more than that. You did a great deal.
Oh, well.
It's important that the information is there for archivists and historians and authors and students and anybody who would want that. But it's additionally important for us at Bletchley Park so that we can make the experience more authentic, that it's absolutely true to what it was when you were there, so that visitors will get to understand and realise and appreciate and respect what you did. And I also find that it's important to be able to, once the story is finished, to be able to give a copy back to the family and have a copy of the sound recording as well. And that's something that will last for generations. So
it's
a threefold benefit for what we do. And I get an enormous kick out of doing this.
Your story is fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing it with us.
And
I hope it brings you some pleasure to think that it's captured in a lasting way now, and that when years and years from now people want to learn about what happened in intelligence in the Second World War, your story will be part of that.
Oh, well, simple as it was, of course, but just a cog in the wheel.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you. I'm sure you're ready for some refreshment.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.